It's here and now. I'm Eric Westervelt. On Friday in Rio, the opening ceremony kicks off the 2016 Summer Games. And all week, we're talking with former Olympians about their lives during and after the Games. Today, Frank Shorter. In 1972, he towed the starting line for the Olympic marathon in Munich, West Germany.
Today, he is the fastest man in the marathon field. No one has run 10,000 meters as fast as Frank Shorter. He was the top-rated marathoner in the world last year. He is a heavy favorite.
Shorter lived up to the billing. He won the race. But his triumph followed tragedy, the killing of Israeli athletes by Palestinian terrorists in an event that stunned the world. Jim McKay of ABC Sports captured some of the shock.
They have now said that there were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. Nine were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone.
4 years later in Montreal, Frank Shorter finished second in the Olympic marathon, losing to an East German runner who was eventually linked to that country's systemic doping program. But his athletic achievements are just part of his life story. He and his siblings survived a monstrously abusive father whose outbursts of physical and sexual violence scarred the entire family. Frank Shorter's new book is My Marathon, Reflections on a Gold Medal Life. He joins us from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Frank Shorter, welcome to Here and Now.
Well, thank you, Eric. It's great to be back.
I have to start with your father and the abuse you and your 10 siblings suffered, because as you write in the book, the abuse in some ways fueled your running life and how you lived your life. Your dad, Dr. Samuel Shorter, to the outside world, was this selfless, kindly family doctor in upstate New York. But the reality at home, behind closed doors, was very different. Tell us about his dual life.
Well, it was. He was a totally different person. When he came home, his main purpose at home was to discipline his children and then also to stifle any creativity or goals or anything else about them. My conclusion really is he's one of those few human beings who didn't want his children to exceed him. I realized at five when he was beating me up one day, he would come home and interrogate my mother late at night. And then his modus operandi was then decide which child he was going to discipline. And we would wait for, and we'd hear him come up the stairs, and we'd just have to see into whose room he would go and who he would drag out of bed and beat. And I found that at about age eight, I began to spend a lot of time out of the house, and I started to run. And then I realized that this was really stress relief for me because when I was out there, out of the house, running, he couldn't get me. He couldn't catch me. That really is how I got into the running, to minimize stress and cope rather than to have goals of going to the Olympics.
You found out almost by accident that, you know, to escape your dad's control and physical and in some cases sexual abuse, running was the perfect outlet.
It was, because it was something he didn't do. He wasn't an athletic person. And so I think it was part of my first way to not be like my father. And now as an adult to look back and realize, I think I had this instinct of not passing this along. And I tell all young kids when they start in sports, I say, try all sports, because there is a biomechanical movement that every person loves and enjoys the most. Mm. And mine happened to be running. I found I just loved moving across the ground. Mm. I could think about whatever I wanted, and I was safe.
Skipping ahead to 1972 and the Munich Olympics, which really was a turning point. We heard that TV clip from 72. You were right across the courtyard from where the Israeli athletes were staying when the Black September terrorists attacked. You heard some of the first shots. Did you know right away this was an attack? Take us back there.
I was sleeping on the balcony. It was like 4 in the morning, and I said, I've been out here for several days. It's the first time I've heard this. This is not a door slamming. This is a gun. And as we went through the day, we just stood out there on the balcony and looked across. And at one point, if people can remember, there's a famous photograph of one of the terrorists in a balaclava with a submachine gun on the balcony. Well, we saw that person. And that shows you how naive we were. It had never happened before, and all he had to do was just sort of spray bullets at us if he wanted to, because we were that close. But we were, in a sense, all in shock.
Frank, after the attack, the games were paused for a few days, and you and your teammates debated going home, not competing. But you ended up staying, of course. And then, you know, the morning of race day, you laced up and ran the marathon of your life. How could you put out of your mind this horrific attack, and how did you process it in order to win?
Well, I think the modern term is compartmentalize, and I think I learned at a very young age. When I went outside the door of my house, which was a prison, I could just turn off thoughts and focus on things over which I had control. So that's what I would do. In effect, blot it out and then think about it when it was appropriate, because the only thing over which I had control was fear, and fear of what the terrorists might do, and I was just not going to let them win on that.
Frank, you had running. Your 10 siblings may not have had that kind of powerful outlet. How have they responded to your writing of this book? Has it helped them at all?
I think it's helped them more than me, because I'd say, I won't go into exact people, but I think only about half of my siblings really emerged into adulthood well. And when it came time to corroborate the initial magazine story that was published in Runner's World in 2011, they said, well, and by the way, the story came out, I just brought up the subject in a story, you know, an interview on, okay, what's he doing now? And then the editor at Runner's World, a fellow named David Willey, basically said, hold the phone here. And they sent John Brandt, who became the collaborator on you know, this most recent effort, sent him back, and we talked about what had gone on. And they needed to corroborate the story because my father had died. And they said, well, we want to talk to your sisters. And my initial reaction was, no way. You're not going to do that. Because, you know, I wasn't going to bring, I would never, ever want them to think that I was doing something at their expense and doing something for myself that required them to revisit something that they didn't want to. And so one of my sisters fortunately acted as an intermediary, and even with sisters that she doesn't get along with, that shows you the dysfunction, it just continues. And they opened up, and the story just became even more horrific. I mean, there were rapes. There were, it was horrific abuse. And it was good, better for them, I think. And when my brother died last year, which was sort of the impetus to maybe finally write the whole story and how it fit in the context of my life, you know, how I think about things, how I do things, and where it came from, they were much, much, not happier, but they were more relieved, I think, to finally have it out there, because part of this process is, number one, you really, really have the kind of fear of this kind of person that you can't describe, and it lasts your whole life. You fear this person in a way that is indescribable.
Your family was traumatized and gripped by fear.
And then, you know, the other part of it being that by their being able, you know, to talk about it, it actually is true. And I think part of that is you wonder, since it was so horrific, and I know my sisters did too, am I making this up? You know, have I imagined it as worse than it was? And we all found out, no, it was worse than we thought it was. And so it really was good for them, because now there's no sort of undercurrent anymore when we get together. I think that's the best way to describe it.
Switching gears back to the Olympic movement, in Montreal, 4 years after the 72 gold medal, you lost to an East German who was later connected to systemic doping, performance-enhancing drugs. Here we are in 2016. The Russians have been banned, the track and field team, because of doping. I mean, why should the public be optimistic at all that they can clean up track and field, let alone any other sport?
Because a model exists, and it's United States anti-doping, which has no conflict of interest. And right from the start, when I was involved in the beginning and was chairman of the board for 3 years, our saying was, you can't promote and police. You have to be totally independent. And that was the structure of U.S. anti-doping. It's a model. And world anti-doping, really along the same lines. So all you would have to do would be take away drug testing from all the international federations, and have Thomas Bach, who's the head of the IOC, say, to all these federations, if you don't do this and create an independent drug testing agency with no conflict of interest, in other words, no promoting and policing together, you can't be in the Olympic Games. And guess what? We're going to audit your program frequently enough that you're really going to have to show that you're truly independent and transparent. And this independent agency has control over all aspects of doping, you know, the testing, the adjudication, the appeals, education, everything. And that model is USADA. And Thomas Bach could do that tomorrow.
Gold medalist Frank Shorter, his new book is My Marathon, Reflections on a Gold Medal Life. Frank, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.